Good morning. Lovely to see you all, particularly so many old faces, I was going to say. Sorry, I should say familiar faces would be a better thing. Actually, it was my birthday this week, and I had the usual rude cards from my children about my age. For those of you who are in any doubt about this, I'm a man in my very, very late 40s, just so that you're aware of that, I'm grateful for any encouragement that you might give me. My children were delighted. I was coming to Gold Hill this morning and wondered if there was wheelchair access to the church for an older preacher. So it's good to have children, preferably some distance away from you when they become adults. It's great to be here. Thank you so much. My wife, Jan, for those of you who know her, sends her greetings. She's leading worship in Oxford this morning and couldn't sort of rearrange that to be here, but she sends her love to so many of you. Thank you for praying for Clarion and the ministry, which continues. I'm pleased to say God's opening amazing doors around the world. And for those of you who do know the ministry and pray for it or support it financially, that's an incredible encouragement, and I thank you. This autumn sees some amazing opportunities opening up. I did have a conversation just on Friday. I'd already committed to going back to Burundi in Central Africa this autumn, and where they pulled 2,000 leaders together last year where I went to speak, and I heard on Friday that they're anticipating 50,000 leaders this year when we're there. So just an amazing opportunity. Earlier this year, I had an opportunity to speak to the annual High Court Judges Conference in Uganda, talking about the relationship between the Bible and justice, and at least 20% of those judges in Uganda are Muslims, and so an opportunity to talk about the gospel and the value of Christian faith in that context. Just last night, I was speaking in Cambridge, at one of the university colleges, in a business context, to a crowd that was 80% not Christians, with a free opportunity to share the good news of Jesus. That's exciting, isn't it? Fantastic opportunity to share this good news. And so Clarion continues apace. I'm glad that Sue Pohl is here this morning. Sue is the administrator of Clarion Trust and my, I was going to say assistant. Sometimes she's so busy I feel like I'm assisting her. But Sue's sitting there at the back in blue, and if you want to ask more about Clarion Trust, she'd be delighted to help you. Julia Krellin is also here this morning, who used to work in that role and clearly found me too much to cope with after a while, and so moved into other more productive areas. But she can also tell you about Clarion, as can others. I'm delighted this morning that Caroline's been baptized. We have all the elements of Christian history here this morning. The Word of God, what are sometimes called the Eucharistic sacraments. We don't usually call them that in Baptist circles, but bread and wine, an open pool, all the elements of celebration of historic Christian faith this morning. And you've been studying John's Gospel, and just for a few moments, I'd like to talk about John's Gospel. I don't know whether we can get the words on the screen. If we can, that will be wonderful. John 12, 37 to 46. Obviously, in a morning like this, there's not time to expound in detail this passage, but one or two key points can be made. Even after Jesus had performed so many signs in their presence, they would not believe in him. That's the key takeaway, by the way. We'll look at some of these other verses in a moment. They wouldn't believe in him despite the signs. Over the years, as I've talked with Christians and non-Christians, particularly people in academia who don't have faith, sometimes they say to me, someone said to me recently, Steve, I would believe in this gospel you talk about if you could show me a miracle. What? Do a miracle and I'll believe. Something incredible. Show it me. And I'm reminded of this verse here. Jesus did all these miracles and they still didn't believe. In fact, at one point they said to him, show us a sign, Jesus, show us a sign. And he said, this unbelieving generation isn't going to get a sign apart from this sign, which was going to be, of course, the resurrection, Jesus alive from the dead. So is seeing believing? If you see a miracle, will you believe? The answer is probably not. And the reason for that is that if someone is predetermined not to believe in Jesus, a miracle won't convince them otherwise. If they're open, then the miracle may draw them in that general direction. Now, just make this simple point right at the beginning. It may be the most important point here. Caroline's about to go through the waters of baptism as a symbol and a sign of a changed life, down into the pool, back up out of the water. We know what baptism symbolizes, and more than symbolizes, is an opportunity for a fresh touch of the Holy Spirit. It's a new beginning. The thing about Christianity is, it's not that seeing is believing. It's the opposite, actually, in most cases. Believing is seeing. The more faith we have and trust, the more likely we are to see divine activity wherever we go. There's an old hymn, which if you're older, you may remember singing it. And it's very old-fashioned words. It says, "Something lives in every hue Christless eyes have never seen." It's a very old hymn. Something lives in every bit of God's creation. But if you've not got Jesus, you don't see it. And so the great thing, and Jesus is always saying this, when he sees someone's faith, he works a miracle. It's not the miracle producing the faith. Interestingly enough, the reverse often takes place in the pages of the New Testament. And so we're called as a congregation this morning, Christians, perhaps some here this morning, not yet followers of Jesus, called into a faith system, a trust in Jesus, which will result in us seeing the activity of God. Because from the outside, Christianity looks boring and dull and predictable. And, you know, it looks like you're exchanging the wild party life for a little piece of bread and a little drink of wine. Seems a bit miserable, really. You'd think there'd be at least a decent loaf. And people think of Christianity as this sort of rather mealy-mouthed thing. And it's only when you're inside looking out that you actually see the wonder of faith. Believing is seeing. And so the reverse of what people often think is true. This was to fulfill the word of Isaiah, who said, "Lord, who's believed our messages? People haven't believed it. For this reason, they couldn't believe." Because as Isaiah says elsewhere, it's just like John's going, "I'm sure it's in Isaiah somewhere. Can't quite remember where in Isaiah it is, so he just says elsewhere." It's like pastors of churches, by the way, who forget your name. And they go, "How are you, brother?" Because that way it covers up the fact you can't remember Fred and you're supposed to know them and you really know them well, but it just won't come to your brain at the right time. So it says somewhere in Isaiah, who knows, "He has blinded their eyes and hardened their hearts." And moving swiftly on, Isaiah said this because he saw Jesus' glory, a pre-incarnate Jesus. He saw it in his mind's eye in the realm of the Spirit and spoke about him. "Yet at the same time, many leaders believed in him." This was the great contradiction of the first century. Huge antagonism towards Jesus from Pharisees, from Sadducees, from religious leaders, from Roman authorities. Huge antagonism, criticism, negativity. And yet, people still believed. Some came to believe. These verses look like God is deliberately stopping people have faith, hardening their hearts. Actually, it's that God simply allows people's unbelief over time. He says, "If you want to keep on rejecting me in this hard-hearted way, I'll give you over to that hard-hearted rejection. I will take your free will seriously if you keep on rejecting me." By the way, it's quite important to distinguish between doubt on the one hand and unbelief on the other. If you're here this morning and you've got lots of questions about faith, faith doesn't come easily to you. Some mornings you wake up and you're not quite sure you believe it all. It seems a bit vague and hard to grasp. That's not the unbelief that's described here. That's human doubt. And human doubt comes to us all from time to time. So Jesus is very gentle with the doubters, but hard on the unbelievers. It's quite an important distinction there. Those who set their hearts as the Pharisees did, aggressively, angrily. We will not believe. You've shown us loads of miracles and we're still not believing. We are determined not to believe. That sort of attitude. I meet people like that from time to time, sometimes quite often, who've aggressively set their face, knowing the facts, against belief. But doubt's not the same thing. So if you've come this morning, and you're not in that position, I suspect, of hard unbelief, because if you were, you wouldn't be here. But you're here probably because you're full of faith, or because your faith is tinged with doubt. And if you are, Jesus comes to you with solid levels of encouragement and assurance. And you'd be among the leaders who believed in Jesus, not just those who rejected him. And the next verses, please. But because of the Pharisees, here's an interesting thing. I've been doing a piece of research recently about structures in society, about how structures like a government department, National Health Service, the Post Office, a denomination, a Christian denomination, a missionary agency, any human structure, and trying to work out why over time they tend to either incompetence or evil. Why is that? And I've been thinking about the ministry of the New Testament. Whenever Jesus confronts the Pharisees, plural, when they come to him as a mob, he's very negative. You've done this, you've said that, you've put burdens on people you shouldn't have done. Why did you do that? Very negative about the Pharisees. But every time he meets a Pharisee, individually, he's gentle and encouraging and has a completely different response. Because the structure of the Pharisaical and the Sadducean, actually, corpus of people created its own momentum of rebellion against the divine will. And so Jesus wants to extract the individual from being corrupted by the structure and give an opportunity to receive his love and care. Look at the way Jesus deals with the Pharisee Nicodemus in John 3. You've covered that over the months. Gently encouraging. Look at the way Luke in the Acts of the Apostles references Gamaliel, a Pharisee, much more affirming and gentle. And so sometimes structures destroy individuals. Sometimes I hear people speak in the context of, for example, a church members meeting, and you listen to them speak and you think, I thought you were nice. Because in a context of a group, people behave sometimes very differently from individuals. So here's Jesus saying, some leaders believed because I took time with them. And God doesn't look at a congregation this morning and sees this group. He sees Carolyn getting ready to make a lovely statement of faith. And he sees you and me individually. Doesn't think of you as part of the medical profession or the teaching profession or a business profession of some kind. He sees you as a woman or a man who is in need of grace and forgiveness and joy. And as you believe and put your little bit of faith in him, the faith of a mustard seed, a little bit of faith, he'll come to meet that faith with his grace and his love. Whoever believes in me doesn't believe in me only, but in the one who sent me. And then the last bit of this passage is really saying, if you see me, you see the one who sent me. If you want to know what God's like, by the way, you should look at Jesus in the Gospels. Because if you see in the Synoptics, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, and then in John, Matthew, Mark, and Luke are the Synoptics, if you look at those four books, you get a picture of the Son of God. And so if you want to know what God's like, you can see how Jesus acts and behaves and thinks, and that's something to help us understand the divine God Father we can't see in the same way. So if you want to go to the end of the... is this the last verse, Howard, here? Thank you. I have come into the world as a light, so that no one who believes in me should stay in darkness. So this morning we have the great joy of witnessing a baptism, and we have an opportunity, therefore, to refresh our own baptism. I was baptized as a 14-year-old boy in a church in Preston in Lancashire. I was one of 13 teenagers who were baptized that morning. And I remember the excitement doing it. There'd been a class, actually, for those, my parents are both Christians, and I really owe my personal salvation to them, personally. I can tell you that there was a class for baptism class. And I only signed up to go because there was a girl who went that I quite liked, which I accept fully now is not a holy motivation. I accept fully that. But actually, God has a good sense of humor. And during the course of this elongated class session, it became clear to me that actually I did believe this stuff and that I ought to express it in some way. I'd already made a decision as a seven-year-old boy kneeling at my bedside to follow Jesus. And I did feel, even as a little boy, I can remember it now, kneeling at my bedside, that sort of a light came on in my brain. I can't describe it in any other way. When I started preaching, my first preaching was as a 15-year-old in the small churches of Lancashire, preaching at village churches with about eight people in the congregation. I really thought I was a great preacher in those days. Little did I realize how bad I was. I hope I've got slightly better over the years. I was really frustrated that I gave my life to Christ as a seven-year-old when I was a teenager, because I read all these great stories about people getting saved from a background of, you know, street gang violence and things. And I was really frustrated that I didn't have an exciting testimony story. I wanted to stand up on platforms and say, you know, I was involved in all sorts of illicit drugs, sex with a different girl every night, partying all the time, and then I was converted at the age of seven. It just really didn't ring right, you know. It sounded so boring, my story. But the key question is this: not where you've come from, but where you're going to. The light dawns. And I would like to say, just as I close, what a great thing it is to have the light of Christ shine in our souls, and that when we believe, we are much more likely to see, rather than claiming and looking for the miracle that people ask Jesus for, in order that then they would have something to believe in. Christianity is best understood from the inside out, not the outside in. Many years ago, when I first, before I came to Gold Hill, actually, I had a presidential role within the wider Baptist family, and that involved me with working with the trade union Congress and with members of Parliament and others. And I often used to go to the House of Commons. And in those days, there was no security. You didn't have to go through any security. And the entrance to the House of Commons you always went to was called the St. Stephen's entrance. Very unimpressive entrance. And when you got there, you thought, I'm going to the mother of parliaments worldwide. And you go through this little door. It's very unimpressive, St. Stephen's entrance. But as you walk through the door, it opens out into this magnificent hall. And you think, wow. The House of Commons is only understood from the inside out, not the outside in. If you think it's just this little door, no wonder you don't want to go through. It's not very exciting. But once you're in, wow. The scale, the splendor, the sheer impressiveness of the building. And my experience of Christian faith is this, that from the inside out, we see God at work. From the inside out, we're aware of his activity. From the outside, most of Christian faith, for many people, simply looks very unappetizing. Jesus said, I'm not going to give you a miracle apart from the miracle of my resurrected body. You won't believe. If you've decided not to believe, you're not going to. But if you just got doubt, if you're just struggling, I want you to know I will meet you. I will meet you. And I would say that to everyone this morning who's struggling with doubt. And I'd just say this, in fact, to all of us. As we persevere in our faith, in good times and in bad, and put our trust daily in the one who gave his life for us, which we'll celebrate in bread and wine. As we do that, so our eyes are opened to the amazing activities of the living God. Albert Einstein once said, there are only two kinds of people in the world, those who think nothing is a miracle and those who think everything is a miracle. I just want to say to you that we live in a very deeply broken world. A world in which there are not just floods in Texas, but wars in Congo and Somalia and Ukraine and Russia and Iran and Israel and Gaza, and brokenness everywhere. But nevertheless, towering over the planet is the message of hope in the one who cannot be seen with the physical eye, but is alive and real and longs to meet people in their hour of need.